When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
It was a nation state adopting Bitcoin. The next is a nation state that has their own currency adopting Bitcoin.
Yes.
The nation state that prints their own currency to buy Bitcoin is going to be a huge deal.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast, coming to you once again from El Zonte in El Salvador. We are live in studio, and on today's episode, it is an honor and a pleasure to be talking to the founder and CEO of Strike. This is Jack Mallers. Welcome to the show, man.
What's going on, brother? It's an honor to be here. I'm a fan, so thanks for having me.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you. Well, Jack, I know who you are, but for my listeners who are not familiar with you, please introduce yourself.
Oh, man. The biggest question I've ever been asked in an interview. No, my name's Jack. I'm probably known as the Bitcoin guy, founder of Strike, but Strike's a baby. Strike's 4 years old. I've been in Bitcoin for over a decade. Mm. So my entire adult life, I've been in Bitcoin. I live it and breathe it. And that's probably what I'm most known for is my contributions to Bitcoin and the conviction I have in Bitcoin. And it's hard to survive anything for over a decade. So just the fact that I've been around.
Okay, man. And there's a lot to talk about here because you're a young guy. How old are you?
I just turned 30.
Just turned 30.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome, man. Welcome to the 30 Club.
Thank you,
buddy. How does it feel?
The same.
Yeah.
Chilling.
30s are better than 20s. If you do your 20s well,
why is
then
that?
Your 30s are better. Because you are still very much a young man, but you have that decade of experience and expertise and success, and you're still in great health and physical fitness and all that. So you kind of have all the youth and energy of your 20s, but you're just a lot more accomplished and have a lot more knowledge. So I've personally found like my 30s to be, I enjoyed my 20s, but my 30s have been way better because it's just like you're the same version of yourself, but just like you're just like upgraded.
Sure.
You're you, but you're upgraded. You're not at the age where, okay, your body is starting to get those aches and pains and, you know, you're physically not able to do the things you could and you're lacking the energy that can happen as you eventually get older, as I understand it. But yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I definitely feel older spiritually, not physically, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure. I couldn't tell that was because I was 30 or because I decided to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
That also ages you pretty quick. But yeah, totally, man. I feel good.
Awesome, man. Well, Jack, I've heard you speak on stages. I've heard you speak on a lot of different podcasts. I've heard you talk a lot about Bitcoin and I love your passion for it. But I was just saying before we started rolling that strangely enough, I feel like I don't know that much about you and your story. So where are you from? Tell me about the Jack Mallers story.
Yeah. No one's ever asked me. Everyone's like, what's the Bitcoin price going to be next year? And no one's like, hey, man, how you doing? Yeah. What's your hobbies? No, I'm just kidding. I grew up in Evanston, Illinois. It's a suburb outside of Chicago. The way I got into Bitcoin is through my dad, a very close relationship to my father. My grandfather was the chairman of the Chicago Board of Trade once upon a time, which I think the internet mistakens for this like luxurious, like he's in the CIA. I mean, he died broke, but he was a pioneer in what is now the derivatives market, futures market, agriculture, commodity, risk transfer markets. And my dad founded a discount futures brokerage with him. And so very intimate in Chicago finance, which is distinctly different than New York. And so I grew up very close with my father, and I'm trying to think of how to describe Chicago finance and Chicago in general is, you know, brick by brick, very morals, ethics, principles. You know, when I played sport is never resume play without helping your teammates up type of attitude. And so that was a lot of my upbringing is being raised by traders, hustlers, salt of the earth, passionate, ethical, moral guys.
Awesome.
And they ended up getting me into Bitcoin. So, yeah, I mean, I could tell you whatever you want to know. Open book. I dropped out of college, whatever you want to know.
We all know that in today's fast-paced world, it's harder than ever to live a healthy lifestyle. Just about everyone is struggling with gut issues, stress, inflammation, fatigue, or immune issues. Most of it comes down to diet, but getting nutrient-rich food consistently isn't always easy or affordable. With hectic schedules, processed foods, and the rising cost of healthy options, we all need a cheat code as the game of life gets more difficult. My cheat code is Optimal Human. With over 90 ingredients, including powerful vitamins and other nutrients, one serving of Optimal Human helps me fulfill my daily nutritional needs. And in my opinion, it tastes better than many of the other green supplements on the market. Optimal Human contains powerful superfoods like organic reishi mushroom for your brain, turmeric root for your joints, beetroot for cardiovascular health, CoQ10 for cellular health, and probiotics for gut health. It's simple to integrate into your daily life. Just add one scoop to water, a smoothie, or your protein shake and get an instant, delicious nutrient boost. Try Optimal Human today and get 50% off your first month by going to optimalhuman.com/Zuby. That's optimalhuman.com/Zuby, and you'll get 50% off your first month. Go check it out.
So you went to college. What did you go to study?
Chess.
Chess.
So not actually, but I went to St. John's. I had a little bit of scholarship money to go. So I grew up a chess player. I have a state championship at the time for my age group. I have two in Illinois. I was nationally ranked growing up for my age class. Played on the chess team in high school. It was funny. It was the only guy that was on the basketball team and the chess team. So I wanted to, my dad was like, listen, you're almost 18. You got to like be an adult and do real things. And I was like, well, gosh, I'm not ready to do that. He's like, well, what do you want to do with yourself? I said, I want to play chess. He said, well, then figure it out. And so I found a university in New York, which at the time, arguably still is the chess capital of the world. Now it's either New York or St. Louis.
Okay.
But at the time, it was New York. And I went with some scholarship money to go pursue chess. Unfortunately, I pursued it a little too much. I skipped every class and I would play in Central Park. So I would ditch class. I would play in the park for cash and I would train there and back. And so I didn't even last a semester.
Mm. What was your major that you were supposed to be doing?
Jesus.
can't remember.
Yeah. Business. I mean, there's a... Yeah. I famously remember, I've told this story a few times, sitting in French literature class. And I texted my dad, and this is just the relationship that we have, so close. I was like, dude, what am I doing here, man? French literature? I'm trying to play chess.
Yeah.
And so eventually, I dropped out. I dropped out before Thanksgiving break. So, I mean, for those that are unfamiliar with U.S. schooling, that's... you enroll a month before Thanksgiving break. Thanksgiving break is usually when a freshman would say, oh man, I haven't seen my parents in a month. I can't wait to sleep in my own bed. I just never went back.
Yeah.
So it didn't last long, but I was trying to pursue a passion. Thankfully, I fell into Bitcoin on the back half of that. But yeah, chess player that got lost in New York City because I was forced to try and figure out this whole university thing that ended up being a waste of time.
Okay, so you said you discovered Bitcoin through your father.
Mm-hmm.
So how did your dad get into the Bitcoin world?
It's a good question. He read a blog. So shout out Mike Krieger. He writes a blog. So my dad went to Duke University. So did Mike. He followed his blog. It was just on overall market trends. Mm-hmm. And Mike wrote about Bitcoin. And my dad picked up on it. You know, Chicago as a whole got Bitcoin a lot earlier than the rest of the world, but especially New York. We're just now seeing New York adopt things like the Bitcoin ETF and be a bit open, more open to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Chicago's very different. I guess the distinct difference between New York and Chicago, Chicago's markets were built on agriculture commodity risk transfer. So I'm talking about the corn farmer, wheat, soybeans. Mm. These are agriculture commodities. So these are commodities that aren't gold and silver. These are commodities that we consume, right? And they wanted to build a risk transfer market because if the corn farmer is worried about if it's going to rain or not, and he isn't sure about the future of his crop, he's going to farm really bad corn. It's going to make us all have diarrhea and be sick. And so what we want is the corn farmer to sell a future and focus really hard on building or farming the best corn he can farm and let a free market transfer that risk. And that was Chicago's core focus and upbringing and unique value proposition in financial markets, which is very different than, hey, I want to take an equity public. Take me to the fancy NASDAQ or the NYSE, insider trading, Wall Street. Chicago doesn't have any of that. And so Chicago got Bitcoin very early because the Bitcoin miner is very much like the corn farmer. It was a lot more free market, some libertarian leaning type of principles. And so he, as soon as he read the blog, he got it. But so did a lot of, this is a la 2000, late 2012, early 2013. That's when all of Chicago got it. Like everyone in finance was aware of Bitcoin and thought openly about it. And so he got into it then. And that was right when I dropped out of school.
That's so interesting. I had no idea that Chicago was early on Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, you've got Cumberland. So DRW's one of the biggest prop firms in the world, I would say, Don Ronald Wilson. And he founded Cumberland around then. You've got Jump Trading. That's Chicago. Okay. They're huge in crypto, but Bitcoin as well. So a lot of the Chicago trading scene was pretty early to Bitcoin. I would just say that the attitude and the approach allowed them to be so. Again, you know, I have harsh feelings and words for New York in the trading scene.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a lot of cornering of markets. There's a lot of insider trading. There's a lot of big banking. And there's not in Chicago. Chicago, if you think about the markets that they built there, is very ethical, principled markets. They wanted to help the corn farmer and ensure that the corn farmer could focus on farming corn.
Yeah.
And that's a really principled, moral thing to do. And that market actually serves a real purpose versus, you know, penny stock trading, Wolf of Wall Street type stuff. And so, yeah, Chicago has a culture that bleeds all the way down to, you know, how I was raised. And I think it allowed them to be, you know, Bitcoin requires you to be open in your thinking and approach. And Chicago has a little bit more of an open, innovative mindset than I think New York is closed and competitive.
That's interesting. So how did that first introduction with your dad go? Did he just say, hey, son, I've read this interesting article. There's this thing called Bitcoin. You might want to look into it. How did that convo go?
I got the best dad in the world, and I think he's a genius. No, he very much understood, you know, the worst way to get someone to adopt something you're interested in is to be forceful on them and criticize them, right? Like, hey, you're an idiot. Pay attention to Bitcoin. Yeah. Thanks for dropping out of school. I wasted a lot of money. Now read this book. It was the opposite approach. He got my stepmother and I into it. He registered the handle Bitcoin Mom. In hindsight, it was genius. At the time, he was like, hey, I'm into this weird, quirky thing that everyone thinks is only for drug dealers. It needs a motherly presence. You know, moms are love. Moms are caring. Moms are inviting. And there needs to be a Bitcoin mom. You know, I'm taking my kid to soccer practice, and I'm interested in this Bitcoin thing. And he registered that handle. And he also found a way to get me into coding school.
Okay.
He would, so I'll never forget, he would drag me out of the basement. I mean, I was depressed, man. I mean, you're 18 years old. All your friends are off making new buddies and meeting women and stuff. And I was sitting alone in my basement. I had no idea what was going on. And he would every morning drag me out of the basement, take me to boxing.
Okay.
And so it was both helpful physically to exercise and see the sun and meet other humans. But also, I mean, I was literally like fighting, and that's what it felt like at the time of my life. And through boxing, he found a friend of his that would get me into a coding boot camp. So he's never admitted it. I thought it was a long con of a way of getting me into Bitcoin was turning me into an engineer. But it was through that where I applied U of I, Iowa, Michigan. I mean, these are Midwest schools where all my friends were. I drifted off to New York, clearly made a mistake. I was going to go party with my friends. And he said, no, I don't think you're ready, and put me in a coding boot camp. And then through that, Bitcoin became immediately fascinating to me, and I really latched on to him and my stepma, and we became a little team.
That's so dope.
11 years ago.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've actually met them both as well.
Yeah?
Yeah, I met them both in 2022, I think. 2022, out at the Bitcoin conference in Miami.
Sure.
They recognized me, and they were, yeah, I remember, I think I took a selfie with them.
Sure.
And they
I
were
mean,
like,
we're fans. Yeah, we're, yeah. I didn't, for sure.
I didn't know. I was just kind of, it was my first time ever in Miami, in fact. And I was like, oh, like that's kind of interesting. And they were like, oh, you know, we're Jack Miles friends. And I was like, oh, awesome. Yeah. Like, your son's doing cool things. So that's funny. So I met them before I met you.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very them.
Awesome. Yeah. So that was 11 years ago. And what's that journey been then? So you're in school doing coding.
Yep.
I can relate to this a little bit because I'm actually a computer science graduate.
Well, there you go.
And I don't like coding. But so maybe I would have gotten into Bitcoin earlier had I not had like the sort of a negative experience with coding during my university degree. But what was the journey from there? How long were you there?
So I went to a 3-month boot camp initially because, I mean, picture being my dad mm-hmm. sends me away to university for like $25,000 and I don't last a month. I don't go to a class. I'm playing chess in the park with a bunch of homeless people. Yeah. And he's like, all right, how do I hedge myself with this clown? I'm going to send him to a 3-month coding boot camp, right? Yeah. And so that's what I went to initially. And I fell in love with it, which okay. meant I knocked it out of the park.
Awesome.
I mean, the classic thing with me is if I care, you'll never meet anyone that cares more deeply. Mm. If I don't, though, I'm going to be the worst yeah. teammate in the world. And so I cared, and I really enjoyed it, and I yeah. loved it. A lot of similarities to chess. And that allowed me to enroll in a 9-month program. So in total, I spent a year.
Okay.
The best part about my engineering career is all of the boot camps and all of the programs I went to don't even exist anymore. It's the funniest part. Everyone's like, wow, where'd you learn to be an engineer? Like, you can't even Google it, man. I could tell you, but it won't matter. So that school is gone. I did a few follow-up programs that was gone. But being an engineer, the hardest part is knowing what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Once you're able to understand what you don't know, understand clearly, not literally because you don't know it, but directionally. Because then you can figure it out. And it challenges you to be resourceful. And so from there, I was resourceful enough to be the classic kid in his bedroom that was hacking away at things he cared a lot about. So I built online chess software that helped me coach other players on the internet, which at the time was very difficult. I built software for a local gym that needed help with their personal trainers, managing all of the data with their clients. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I got good enough to start contributing to Bitcoin. I applied to every company that could spell Bitcoin, and they all rejected me, which in hindsight I'm thankful for. Yeah. But Coinbase, Kraken, I mean, everyone, I was begging to be a part of this thing, and I couldn't find a way in, which inevitably led me to pursue open source. They couldn't fire me from open source software. You could download it from the internet and run it yourself. Mm-hmm. So that one I contributed to, and then through that ended up becoming an entrepreneur and founding Strike. So awesome. That was a high level journey for you.
And what year was that when you were doing these applications? I'm guessing like 2014, 2015?
Yeah. So the homework assignment from the initial boot camp is like build something real.
Yeah.
I actually owe a ton to that school and the founder, Neil. So shout out Neil. It was a different approach to school. It was, hey, welcome to school, but I don't even like calling us a school. We're going to do real stuff for the real world. I'm not going to grade you on how you can spell. I'm not going to grade you on math. I'm not going to grade you at all. You are here to build software that can be used by other people, and that's your assignment. Mm. So find something you care about, and it's going to be really hard, but you're going to do it. And so that's what I did. And I built this chess software initially, and I built software as the very first application I presented was actually crowdsourcing software on how well a referee is doing in an NBA game.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because growing up in Chicago, I'm a huge Michael Jordan fan, and I was convinced that refs would rig games for LeBron James. Mm. And so, but that was the point. It was be passionate, care about something. You know, you exist. And make a dent in the universe. And, you know, we interface with these screens and software, And you have the power to influence that. Mm-hmm. And so where do you want to see change? And I was like, I want to see LeBron James at the free throw line less. It's like, I swear he gets more calls than whatever, the San Antonio Spurs. So I built that. That was in 2013. Well, the problem is it didn't really work.
Okay.
All of my buddies in high school came over for the launch, and it like barely worked, but they were happy because I bought them all wings. So I'm still convinced that the NBA, the point of the software, I'll pitch it. Someone else should build it.
Okay.
The point of the software was the crowd knows best, right? If you can outsource information to as many people as possible, the bigger the crowd, the smarter the wisdom. Mm. And so if I was able to log NBA games in real time and allow fans to say, hey, was that a good call or not? With enough of a populace, we'd be able to actually crowdsource an official opinion of what the world thought about that officiating as opposed to, and to the specific call. And I would pull a bunch of data where when LeBron James is reffed by this guy, then he goes to the free throw line twice as much as other referees. And so I was convinced that I was correct. And so that's what it was intended to do. It didn't work because I was an engineer for 90 days at the time, and I wasn't good. But that was 2013. And so I completed schooling through the beginning of 2014, and I built the chess software. I got to meet a mentor still to this day, Jason Fried of Basecamp. And that was the beginning of my career where I, for the first time, felt confidence in myself.
Yeah.
You know, I think in my career, I will say there are certain parts where people believe in you more than you believe in yourself.
100%.
And, you know, those are a lot of the people I have to thank along my journey. So my father, you know, when I thought I was a loser, that was a college dropout, he believed that I wasn't. In this school, you know, Jason Fried, these guys believed that I was good enough to be an engineer. I didn't need to go to school, and I was creative and passionate enough. And just, you know, I think chess is the art of seeing yourself forward, and they saw that in me, and that you don't think about going back to college. You got this. Mm-hmm. That was a moment, and I've had a lot of those throughout the career, my career. So, yeah, that was around 2014 where I said, yeah, I got this.
Yeah.
And it was a different energy and different trajectory since that point.
That's dope. It's so interesting to hear that, because I think that's such an important and deep human point that is so often overlooked, which is that people need encouragement. People need encouragement. People need people to believe in them and see their potential even when they don't. And the difference between being that guy who is in the basement and needs to be dragged out to go and do things and who isn't feeling confident. I mean, you're the same person. And you can probably imagine this sort of like bifurcation in your life where had certain circumstances been different and certain people not been there to urge you on and encourage you and believe in you, you could just kind of stay in that rut. And I believe there are millions of people right now scattered around the world who are just in that rut. They have so much potential. They've got talent. They've got so much ability to do great things. But no one has told them that. No one's ever encouraged them. And it's sad when people miss that, because it can just make such a small difference. I mean, I'm sure you see this because you've got a big platform, right? And I'm sure you've had people who are massively encouraged and inspired by you and, you know, might even tell you a certain story or something you said on a podcast or something you posted. And it fundamentally was just, it was just that spark that they needed at the time to change their life. I've had so many people come up to me and tell me that, like, man, I just read this thing that you wrote that one day or this thing you said, and I was here and it just, you know, nudged me. So I think that's extremely powerful. I think that's a good lesson for anyone listening, just to know for yourself and for how you engage with other people, particularly people who are listening. I know a lot of people who are listening to this podcast are parents when it comes to your own children. Just giving them that encouragement, it's such a huge difference.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the value of those that you surround yourself with. Right? I think back, and if I didn't have the dad I do, if I wasn't in that school, I found myself at certain points in my life in the wrong crowd. You know, college dropout in the parks, playing till the sun goes down with a bunch of people that didn't even have a home. Mm. And it would have been very difficult to find the best version of myself through them, I think. And it's no offense to any individual, but more so speaking to the value of just surrounding yourself with the right people. And that also is, I think, what allowed me to travel so deeply into Bitcoin mm-hmm. is because all of a sudden I had a little bit of confidence and faith in myself, and I was surrounded by the brightest minds in the whole world. I mean, there's no more ambitious task than trying to fix money. And so I was this young kid who had a little bit of energy, and then all of a sudden everyone around me was smarter, wiser, nicer, kinder, healthier. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything that you would want out of a human life. And so, yeah, that was my takeaway, was just how important the company you keep. And I was lucky enough to have a really amazing father, but there's no real excuse. We all have the ability to build a relationship. And so ever since, I've taken relationship and that lesson pretty seriously.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. So what is it that particularly sold you on Bitcoin? Was there a moment where you just saw it and were like, this is the thing? What's the story there?
I think it's the classic, you know, come for the number go up, stay for the revolution. But in the beginning, I was really cheering my dad on. He was so convicted and had this position, and my stepmother got into it. And there's something about, you know, just having so much love for my family and my parents. I wanted this thing to work. And through that, you evaluate, well, is it going to work or not? And you come to the conclusion that, you know, Bitcoin's designed to go up forever. Well, I believe that. And, you know, what hard money means, what a fixed supply means, where anything monetary derives value from, how money works, what properties it needs to have. And you come to this conclusion of, oh, man, this is the best money that we have. And so I initially was convicted and sold through that. And then the revolution is what follows. And you realize the knock-on effects that having better money has for yourself, for your family, for your business, for your country, for our species.
Yeah.
And that, you know, things like El Salvador are much more for the revolution than the number go up. Mm-hmm. But initially sold, I was like, you know, is this thing going to work? And you have to build your own conviction in that. And I fell in love with the fact that I felt like I knew something that the rest of the world didn't. Mm-hmm. I remember walking around with my parents and like, that guy has no idea that this Bitcoin thing's going to be huge, but we do. And that's what it felt like. And it was a really charming feeling, especially to do it with your family.
That's amazing. This is not explicitly a Bitcoin podcast. Mm-hmm. So there are going to be a good chunk of people listening to this who have heard about Bitcoin. Maybe they've heard another Bitcoiner on the podcast here or there. They've seen me mention it maybe, but they don't know what it really is. They mm-hmm. don't know the value proposition. They don't know what you mean when you say it's programmed to go up forever. So I want to kind of go back to basics a little bit.
Sure.
So for someone who's just listening to this podcast, who's maybe heard about Bitcoin, but they haven't really thought about it and been exposed to it properly, can you give them the 101 on what the Bitcoin value proposition is in your eyes?
Totally. Yeah. I actually think the best place to start is understanding money a bit better. I like to think of money as our time and our energy in an abstracted form. What I mean by that is you do this podcast, in exchange for that, you get money. I run Strike, in exchange for that, you get money. You mow a lawn, you fix a windshield, you drive a car for someone else, you get money. So money is the market good that captures our collective contributions to society. It's intended to capture our time and energy so that that time and energy can either be saved or be traded, right? You can't go to the restaurant after this podcast and say, hey guys, I just recorded a podcast. I'll take two steaks. They'll be like, what? I don't want that. That's what we call barter, mm-hmm. right? To solve for barter and scale the economy and allow us to hyper-specialize on something like a podcast. Like a podcast isn't a tradable market good for dinner, for gas, for groceries, but it is for money. And so money is that market good, again, for abstracted time and energy. Now, if I were to store my time and energy in wheat, for example, let's go through that mental exercise. So I work all day on whatever I'm doing, and in return, I get wheat. Well, how good is that money, is wheat being the money, at persisting and saving through time? Well, it's very bad because it's going to go bad and moldy and stale And so that wheat is going to be worth zero in about a week, right? Everyone has multi bread. And then how good is that money in exchange? Can I send that wheat to Europe on my phone, right? And so thinking of money as how to capture your time and energy is a very powerful idea, as opposed to like a piece of paper or as opposed to something that your government, whatever, tells you to use. Then contrast it to the dollar. If a government can print their own money and debase their money, that means they're debasing by proxy your time and energy. Mm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So also a government's ability to borrow their own money is, in my opinion, as close to time travel as we've ever seen, because you're borrowing the time and energy from the collective populace from the future. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. You're taking time and energy from the future and saying, we'll pay it back at some point. That's as close to time travel and as malicious of an act. But every time the U.S. government prints a dollar, they're devaluing me and my life, because mm-hmm. I've spent time and energy here on this planet. In return for that, I've got U.S. dollars, and now those U.S. dollars are worth less, so I'm worth less.
Yes.
And so the idea that you have a money that's one fixed can't be debased. So the holder, the time and energy of those that hold it cannot be debased, and then that lives outside the purview of a government or a central party or a corporation or any individual is the most powerful concept when it comes to storing our time and energy. And you'd have to think through the history of money. Well, historically, you try and get as close as you can, right? Bitcoin right now, I believe, is as close as we can to the perfect store for our collective time and energy. But once upon a time, it was gold.
Yes.
Why? Because those collection of chemicals get us kind of close. It's harder to find more gold and debase our time and energy than it is silver, than it is copper, right? And people think of real estate as a place to store wealth, store time and energy. Why? Because you can't print any more land. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean you can't print any more real estate, right? They're going to build a building that's 1,000 stories high in Manhattan one day. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to find vehicles that are close enough at the time and energy piece. And in Bitcoin, my interpretation of Satoshi and Bitcoin is the tool that's best equipped to be money, which is the tool that's best equipped to store your time and energy and allow you to save it and exchange it for something in the market. So that advancement is so powerful. Mm-hmm. Here's the last, sorry, I know I'm ranting at
no,
this
it's
point,
all good, man.
But
I love this.
I think the last thing I'll say, and this may get a little weird or dark, but I like to compare the guarantee and promise of Bitcoin as a fixed money to the guarantee and promise of death and that we can't live forever. What I mean by that is that the fact that I'm going to die, and I know I'm going to die, is what allows me to value my life. Mm-hmm. If I knew I could live forever, I'd go to the gym in 10,000 years. I'd think about reproducing in 100,000 years. Yeah. Why would I? The point is, how would I ever be able to value today? Mm-hmm. If there's infinite amounts of dollars, infinite amounts of debt, infinite amounts of printing currency, it doesn't allow me to value the paycheck I'm getting now. And so the promise that I will die is what allows me to value my life. Time as an asset is infinite, but my time isn't. And it's the promise of Bitcoin, the fact that I have a money that is fixed that actually allows me to value my time and energy right now. And so when you hear Bitcoiners say, I got into Bitcoin, I got healthier. I got into Bitcoin, I lowered my time preference. I got into Bitcoin and I thought about the world differently. It's going from a life of infinity, which is impossible to value, to a life that is finite. That requires you to value it. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes complete sense.
To me, it's just a life-altering technology and an advancement in money, which is how we capture, exchange, and save time and energy between each other.
Amen. I think that's one of the best explanations of Bitcoin, not from the tech perspective, but from the value perspective that I've ever heard. So I hope that resonates with the people listening.
Man.
No, for real, that's powerful. I think that Two points. I think two things are really interesting with that, which is one, money is one of the only technologies I can think of, which is worse now, excluding Bitcoin, I'm talking fiat money, is worse now than it was thousands of years ago. The money system, if you were to go back 100 years, 200 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, when things were running off gold and off a gold standard, it was better. That was a better technology in terms of all the things that you're talking about than what we have now. And then I think the second point is just that almost everybody who is alive today, vast majority of people, have never known any different. People are just used to the broken money system. When you even say money, people's brains go to a dollar bill or, you know, euros or pounds or mm-hmm. numbers in the bank account or whatever. People don't really think of money as that stored labor and energy, which you can then use to trade for other people's labor and energy in the form of goods and services, which is what it is. If you work a job, if you run a business, if you have a career, we are all constantly exchanging our time and energy for goods and services, right? It's just constant exchange. And we do that through the medium of money because we can't always barter, as you were saying. But I just think that because it's, you know, when did the US go completely off the gold standard? 1971. Mm-hmm. And I think in the 1930s, the sort of the process began.
It's around the world wars.
Yeah, yeah, or in many places. And so this is just what people are used to, right? It's just like, oh, inflation is just a given. Some people think inflation is good, some people say. And you're just like, wait, if you think about it, the idea that you store $10,000 today and then the next year it's worth $9,500, and then later down the line, you know, you can get to a point where, you know, that $10,000 is now worth $500 or $1,000, and people kind of just accept that. And you're just like, no, that's not meant to happen. And mm-hmm. historically, that wouldn't have happened, to say, if you'd stored your money in gold. I talked to my father, who came to the UK from Nigeria in the 1970s, the first time. My dad's a medical doctor, a physician. And this is the 70s. We're now in 2024. Head of the household of a family of now seven, but at the time would have been five or six. Medical doctor in the UK. What do you think his annual salary was in the 70s?
Geez. In the 70s?
Yeah.
What was a house?
As a doctor.
Like, a house was like 20 pounds, so 8,000 pounds?
4,000.
4,000? Okay.
Yeah, 4,000 pounds a year. That was a good guess. Yeah, that was a good guess. But 4,000 pounds a year as a medical doctor
in the
UK, right? And now you're just thinking like, gosh, I mean, earning 4,000 pounds a month as a doctor wouldn't be a good salary.
You couldn't pay back your loans.
Yeah. And I mean, that's only 50 years ago. It's not that long. You know, he tells me the story of, he and my mom wanted to buy a certain house, which cost like, I think, 15,000 pounds. Not the deposit, the whole house, 15,000 pounds at the time, that would have been maybe $25,000. And, you know, they were like, no, that's out of our budget. You know, we can't afford that. And now in many places, I mean, you can't even get anything under $500,000 in some places, you know, approaching $1 million. So it just shows, when you were talking about them, you know, the Fed or the central banks or governments just stealing from people, stealing labor, stealing value from people born and unborn. It's very real. And I think if people truly woke up to that, then there would be some form of real revolution.
Yeah. Well, I think they are. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, so your dad earning 4,000 pounds a year, and I believe a house, would you say, was 15,000 that they were looking
at? Yeah, maybe, you know, 10,000 to 20,000, depending on what you wanted.
Right. So that sounds like 2.5 to 3 years worth of work to acquire. What's crazy is if people look, I encourage everyone listening to go look into metrics like the average year someone gets married, the percentage of the populace that turns into a homeowner. It's all going very bad. So, for example, everyone used to get married around 22, 23. Everyone's now getting married around 32, 33. Mm-hmm. Life expectancy is going down. Homeownership's going down. Divorce rates going up. And these are all metrics that tell me that in order to live a life what you're pleased with, it's requiring more time and energy. Mm. You know, your dad could have worked 2.5, 3, 4, 5 years to own a home. People are having to work 20, 30, 40, 50 years to own a home. They're still the same humans.
Yep.
So by debasing the currency, again, if you think of it as time and energy in an abstracted form, you're increasing the time and energy required to live a sustainable life. Mm-hmm. And it deteriorates society. It's really an awful, malicious thing to do to, you know, when you say steal from people, they are stealing the time and energy from the collective populace. You know, when your groceries double, when your McDonald's order doubles, whatever that is for you, and your gas price doubles, it's just requiring more time and energy for you to have the life that you need to have.
You know what, Jack? I think you have just nailed a much better definition of what inflation truly is and why it's so bad. The standard definition of inflation is either, you know, increase in the money supply, devaluation of currency, or just prices going up. Someone could say that they're often the same thing. But I think when you think of it as debasing the value of the collective's time and effort, then you see just how insidious it is.
Debasing you.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you made up of?
Mm.
The energy you contribute and the time you have.
Yeah.
That's it, right? Like, your life is capped with the time that you're given, and your life is expressed through the energy that you contribute. And they're debasing and devaluing that. Mm-hmm. So every time they devalue your money, they're devaluing you. And what an awful crime. And so I think we all can feel society deteriorating in many ways. Mm-hmm. Feel people getting angrier, feel civil unrest. We feel whatever metric you care about, whether it's health, cancer rates, the real estate market, all going bad. And I think people are looking for a solution, and I hold the personal opinion that the money's broken. Yes. And when I say the money's broken, it's like our ability to store, save, and exchange time and energy is fundamentally broken. And so why do I care about Bitcoin is, listen, you know, people can have their qualms with Bitcoin, and I appreciate that it's not perfect, and that's why I spend my time on it. But I think it's the closest thing we have to fixing that problem. And there's a saying in Bitcoin, fix the money, fix the world. And when you hear it, when you see it, and you're not familiar enough with the concepts, it sounds maybe a little too insane to take seriously. But that's what we mean when we say that, is that if we can fix the ability to store, save, and exchange our time and energy, I think we can fix a lot of the problems with the world.
Can you connect those dots for people a little bit more? Because I think I know what you're talking about, but I think the jump from going to having a better form of money and then all those other problems that you talked about, family formation, civil unrest, division, familial breakdown, all those kind of things, I think people struggle to connect those dots. So can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah. So, and let me know if I lose you, because these are weird concepts, at least when I try and describe them. But, you know, time and energy, when you say someone's robbed their time and energy, someone's devalued them, stolen their productivity or whatever, however you'd like to describe inflation, it can't disappear. It has to go somewhere else, right? And so maybe the best way to understand that is like the wealth gap that we see, for example, is that less than 10% of the United States owns over 90% of the wealth. And that's because when you debase the currency, everyone that holds it is getting crushed and is needing to require more time and energy to have a sustainable life. And everyone that owns assets that is being inflated. So when they print money, your house gets inflated, your Bitcoin gets inflated, all these things get inflated. They accrue wealth naturally without expending time and energy. And so then you get a really disgruntled populace where 90% of the United States of America is required to expend more time and energy every single year to be able to afford a family, be able to afford children, be able to have a happy marriage, to be able to afford a house, to be able to afford groceries, to be able to afford gas. And then you have the top, whatever, it's not actually 10% anymore, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5% of the populace that actually controls and owns all of the collective time and energy from the populace because they own a pocket of Manhattan real estate. And so that, I think, is the best. There is no middle class anymore. You either own assets that inflate against the debasement or you own the currency that's being debased.
Yeah.
There's no middle class. And so I think that's probably the best descriptor to describe the civil unrest. We feel at war with each other, but I think the real issue is there's a large portion of the population that
I mean, listen, if housing is inflating 20% year over year, you have to be getting a 21% raise every single year to be making progress towards owning a home. Mm-hmm. And so there's an overwhelming amount of the population that is requiring more time and energy to have a life that we recognize as worthwhile. It's really awful.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that is where I think a lot of the unrest comes from. And yeah, I mean, the napkin math on something like, you know, your groceries, let's say your groceries doubled from now to COVID. Let's say it took one paycheck to cover 3 months worth of groceries. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now it takes one paycheck to cover a month and a half.
Yeah.
Right. So if you want 3 months worth of groceries, you have to work twice as hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you expending twice the amount of either energy or time, energy and time, to acquire the same amount of groceries.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst someone who got grandfathered in and passed down some apartment complex in Manhattan now gets even more groceries, and they didn't contribute any time and energy to the collective populace.
Yeah.
They just have it because they had the asset.
And do you know one of the craziest things about this? Is that the numbers and the examples you're using, these are based on places, countries like the USA,
mm-hmm.
which are the most stable and some of the lowest
yeah.
inflation countries, right? UK, USA, and so on. If you talk to people who are in Nigeria or in Turkey or in, lots of developing countries where the inflation rate is not 5, 6, 7, 8, 10%, it's 30, 40, 50, 60, sometimes 100% per year, which is just, I think a lot of people in developed countries can't even fathom that, because you cannot plan anything. You cannot save. You can't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the reason, so Bitcoin is, in my opinion, the expression mm-hmm. of fiat debasement. And fiat debasement is the act of time and energy theft, right, in monetary form. So that's why when I look at a Bitcoin chart, when someone asks, wow, this monetary debasement thing, this theft of time and energy from the populace seems really bad. How bad is it?
Mm-hmm.
I say, look at a Bitcoin chart. You know, that thing that just seems to have gone like a hockey stick, that is the debasement of currency captured in another instrument. I mean, mm-hmm. Bitcoin is the antithesis of everything we're talking about. It's a monetary policy that can't be changed. It's a currency that's fixed in supply, and it's a network that's distributed and resistant against any central control.
Mm-hmm.
And so when something that is printed out the wazoo, a policy that can be changed by politicians, and something that's so centrally planned and controlled is expressed,
mm-hmm.
it's captured in this thing. And so that's the other real beautiful thing about Bitcoin as well. But anyway, yeah, I mean, the problem with money historically is if you can print it, you will.
Yes.
Because energy and time are the currencies of the universe, right? Energy is the currency of the universe. If you think about humanity from the highest level possible, it's really our ability to commercialize energy from the sun. That's what...
Yeah.
The more we're able to commercialize energy from the sun, the more advanced and flourishing our species is. Mm-hmm. And it's just a progressive way of how to engineer a better world, and that's through channeling and commercializing energy. And so if you have access to print energy and allocate it to yourself,
mm-hmm.
you will.
Yes.
And that, you know, you can make the argument that that's really malicious and terrible of someone to do. You can also make the argument that that's human behavior, is that that is the currency of the universe and the currency of our history. And if someone has access to it, they will claim
it.
It's
just incentives.
Correct. And so, yeah, I mean, with that's that to me, when people say, you know, Bitcoin's decentralized, quote unquote, I actually hate the overuse of the word. You know, Bitcoin to me is distributed. Bitcoin to me is, the point is that nobody can access the energy. That's the whole way Satoshi designed
it. Why do you dislike the term decentralized?
I just think it's been commercialized for malintent.
Okay.
I don't dislike it on net, but I think it's been co-opted to the whole concept of Bitcoin was not to be like this super duper decentralized thing that can solve decentralized dentistry. The point was, if you can print time and energy and debase it from the populace of holders, you will. Mm-hmm. So how can we build something where no one can access the time and energy for themselves? And
that's like this proof of work idea, is that in order to acquire the Bitcoin, you have to earn it. Mm-hmm. Like Michael Saylor, he paid billions of dollars of cold, hard cash, real time and energy that he's acquired through his life to get his Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. And that's that concept of proof of work. And so that to me is the system is designed to protect against the idea that human nature is to acquire and monopolize time and energy if they have access to it. And that's the problem with the money we have today, is that it's very easy to monopolize and take advantage of the time and energy, which is our currency.
Yeah. One question I do have about Bitcoin, and I say this about someone who's super passionate about it and has been for years.
Sure. But
one thing I do wonder when we discuss some of these issues is, if Bitcoin goes on and does what we both think it's going to do in the future, and let's say Bitcoin reaches $1 million. At that point, do we not now end up with a society where we still have this gigantic, perhaps even bigger wealth gap, but now the people who are uber wealthy are just different people? Is that not a situation that we end up with?
No.
Okay.
Well, I don't believe so.
Okay.
There certainly will be wealth created. Mm-hmm. Now you can have an argument on whether that wealth creation was deserved and earned. Right? Is someone early to Bitcoin mm-hmm. deserving of the wealth that's being transferred and new wealth that's being created? And there's some people like, no, they're just sitting on their couch. Right? It's Dave Portnoy's mm-hmm. a friend of mine is like, you just sit on your couch for the last 10 years. And then I make the argument that's the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. That I think can be debated in good fun. But the interesting thing about Bitcoin and the point is that you have to put in real work into society to persist the wealth. So even if you have a lot of wealth, your wealth is going to bleed. So let me give you an example. I live on Bitcoin.
Okay.
I don't own any cash. I own only Bitcoin as far as money goes. I own Bitcoin, my house, my company. Those are the three things I own, nothing else. I also don't take a salary from my business. Mm-hmm. So I live on my assets. I have to sell Bitcoin every single month to pay off expenses. The way I do it is I spend on credit cards, and then every month, whatever I need to pay down, I sell the Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And the point of that is that the Bitcoin gets redistributed, right? The only way for me to continue to own the same amount of Bitcoin is if I were to could be earning more than I'm spending. Does
yes.
that make sense?
Yeah.
And so even for someone that has acquired a lot of wealth, in order for them to maintain and persist that wealth, they have to be contributing more to society than they're taking from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's being profitable, whether you're a business or an individual. You're giving more to the world than you're consuming from the world.
Yes.
Right? And so that is the difference in the system, where someone in the fiat system, that's mm-hmm. not the case,
yeah.
is that if I can print the capital, I'm not actually giving time and energy to the world, but I'm receiving it. Where with Bitcoin, it's a fair exchange. Mm. If someone's rich, someone's rich. And if they're able to persist that wealth, that means they're contributing time and energy that society values more than they're consuming from the world, right?
Yes.
And that's the big switch. So of course, they'll be upper class. But in order to remain upper class, you have to be contributing to the world.
Mm.
And that's not true today.
Yeah. You can't just leech off the system or have somebody.
That's right. You have to do stuff.
Yeah.
You have to do things.
Yeah, yeah. That makes complete sense. You know, you're the first person who's given me a proper answer on that.
There we go. What am I? Two for two, three for
yeah,
three.
Man.
You've given me some
yeah,
compliments.
I think about these things a lot because I've been in Bitcoin since 2017, and when I look at it and when I think about that future, I just think, okay, people say they want to solve, you know, you're never going to solve the quote unquote wealth gap problem or whatever. Human beings are different and we're unequal in many ways, although we're equal in, you know, human value, and in God's eyes, I believe we're equal, but you know, people don't work equally hard. People are not equally talented. People are not equal in many regards. So that kind of doesn't make sense. I'm no communist. But yeah, I have always wondered, okay, let's look forward into the future. And you know, you've got guys who got into Bitcoin at, you know, 2009, 2010, whatever, you know, they just kind of stacked it up then some, and then, you know, can kind of just sit on it. And then we get to a point where, I mean, it's interesting when you say Bitcoin being worth $1 million, the immediate question that even comes to my brain is like, what's $1 million worth?
Yeah.
At that point, right? But then I just think, yeah, won't we just end up with the same scenario, but the guys at the top are just different
sure.
guys? Yeah, so that's a very solid answer.
Yeah.
That's a very solid answer.
What you see in Bitcoin adoption is, so in markets, in life generally, with more demand comes more supply. So the reason I can't store my time and energy, which is my wealth, in iPhones is because if all 8 billion people wanted 20 iPhones, Apple will just make them.
Yeah.
So there's more demand, more supply. Bitcoin's the only thing in the world where more demand can't find more supply. And that's why more demand has to find a higher price, right? The reason gold can't work as currency, one of the many reasons, is because with more demand, we'll always find more gold. We don't know how much of it exists. Elon's talking about, I'm going to go to Mars and get it or whatever. And so if more demand has to find higher price because it can't find more supply, then what you see happen is a redistribution through the price cycle. So price gets up to a high enough point where the people, to your point, that have been sitting on the couch, they do get cars, they do get homes, they do get engagement rings, they do get stuff, and that Bitcoin gets redistributed. So when people say miners are the people that distribute Bitcoin, I'd say holders do as well. Every single cycle, you can look at it in a chart. It's like there's enough demand where then
they let go.
Yeah, if I want to find more Bitcoin, I can't find it in the ground. I have to find it in the market. And so I also think that isn't totally appreciated, that the concentration of Bitcoin is naturally going to be distributed.
I think it's hard to – do you know why I think it's hard to understand? Is I think it's something that I said earlier, and I think it's even me myself falling into this trap, which is that we are so used to the fiat money system. And so everything we've known throughout our lives of the way that money is and the way it's distributed, it's all always been based on pounds, dollars, whatever currency. So when you even think of it, your brain doesn't go to like the point that you made. You just think, well, at the moment, there are people who are able to manipulate and move markets and print money and do this and do that. And so you're just used to that world where people can – look, most people have to contribute to make money. But we all know that there are a class of people in certain places where you can, you know, you're just next to, you're the guy who's next to the money machine.
Yeah.
You know, you're the politician who's making certain policies and got certain lobbyists and whatever it is. So you don't need to be out there. I mean, you know, we've got politicians who are, I don't know, they're on an annual salary of 150K and their net worth is like 50 million or something. And you're like, wait, you're outperforming the market by how much? Like this isn't really making sense. You've been a so-called public servant your entire life. You've never started a business. You've never really been employed by a company. And you've why is this person so wealthy?
Yeah.
You know, people get mad at Jeff Bezos or Elon or Bill Gates. I'm like, well, I know why those guys are rich. It's very clear.
Yeah. Going back to like the civil unrest, on top of that point you just made, it's a real shame. You know, the lower class hates the upper class. The upper class dislikes the lower class because they don't feel it's their fault. So when you see, you know, you're scrolling Instagram and you're getting these dopamine hits of social media and you see Jeff Bezos made $10 billion today and they do that. if he donated all of that to Africa, he'd solve world hunger, and they're doing all this stupid math. Listen, it's not Jeff's fault. He didn't – think of it this way. He didn't contribute $10 billion worth of time and energy to the world today.
Yeah.
What happened? Governments debased and stole $10 billion worth of the collective populace's time and energy, and because Jeff owns assets, he benefits from that.
Yep.
And so Jeff is upset because he's like, it's not my fault. I'm just owning the assets and storing my time and energy in things – that appreciate against the debasement, right? And that's where you get the civil unrest from. I think to judge if a society is using a good money is to look at the middle class. That's what a lot of people say because, you know, if I were to say, you know, you're on the first floor now, get to the third floor. So the first floor is the lower class. The third floor is the upper class. But there's no second floor. You're stuck.
Yep.
The third floor can never get to the first floor. The first floor can never get to the third floor. The middle class, the second floor, is how you have the open capitalist society, the free market, to contribute more energy and time to the world that's making you profits to actually transverse and go from floor one to floor three. And so the fact that our middle class has been entirely destroyed, I mean, we're stuck. You're either on the third floor or you're on the first floor, right? And over 90% of America is on the first floor, and they're suffocating, and they're pissed, and they're looking up at the third floor. And so that's another way that I like to think about it. And a lot of the civil unrest, I think, is born out of this idea that it's, you know, one, it's Jeff Bezos' fault. It's not Jeff's fault. He just owns assets. He doesn't own dollars, right?
People blame the wrong people.
Right. That's what they say is, you know, billionaires don't own any dollars. You know that, right? It's all invested. And it's like, buy my investing class. And, but the but the point is billionaires don't own any dollars because that would leave them susceptible to their time and energy being taken from them. So they put it in assets where it's much more difficult to debase the time and energy that they put in to acquire the capital in the first place. So it's not their fault, but the wealth gap gets bigger and bigger the more they debase, And I think they will, I think we'll have to go through the biggest debasement chapter of our lives over the next few years. And so it's really a terrifying time. If we didn't have Bitcoin, I would not have much hope for society, to be honest.
Wow. How do you see it playing out? What do you think is going to happen? Let's say, let me give you a time frame. Let's say we're in 2024. Let's say next 15, 16 years. Let's say like 2040. What do you see playing out between now and then?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm hopeful that the U.S., as really the world leader and world reserve currency, can adopt Bitcoin and we can transition to somewhat of a Bitcoin standard or make Bitcoin more accessible, available, and appreciated in everyday life. But it is difficult to imagine that because the U.S. would have to give up the hegemony that they've really been trying to protect since World War II, right? But in the near term, which may be more interesting because it's real, it's practical, I like to look at global debt to GDP because what that tells me, again, if you can borrow your own currency, then it's as close to time travel as I've ever seen because you're able to go into the future and take time and energy from it and use that time and energy now. The thesis of why anyone borrows anything and people make loans is because you can produce more growth. So the idea is the government's borrowing from our future and they're able to produce the growth today so that when we arrive at the future, they have even more. That's the why you would borrow from it is if you're able to produce more now if you had that time and energy. But with global debt to GDP at well over 300%, so global debt to GDP measures the amount of debt versus the amount of growth. So it's the amount they're borrowing versus the amount of growth that they're producing to pay it back. And we're now at disastrous levels where, you know, any empire that exceeded debt levels of, you know, 150, 200, 300% collapsed.
When you say those numbers, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean the amount they're borrowing is three times what is being produced?
Yeah, so, well, so 100% is double.
Yeah.
200% triple, 300% 4x, 350% is so. It's I like the metric directionally, and you know I don't even you know once it hits 361%, then the world's gonna blow up. I'm more so, what that tells me is that governments have borrowed so much from our future with no way to pay it back, and so when you think of money as time and energy and not you know when people sometimes on television they'll ask me. Well, why don't, you know, they can just print it or they can just roll the debt over. But if you think of it not as a piece of paper and you think of it as our time and energy, you know, that loss has to be realized somewhere. Someone's time and energy has to be used to make that hole fill. And that's a huge problem. And that's a problem that is going to have to be resolved, in my opinion, over the next few years. That's why I think, when I say I think Bitcoin's going to 250,000 to a million, somewhere in that range, soonish, 1, 2, 3 years, people are like, how is that possible? As well, they need time and energy to fill this hole. And how do they get it? Like, they print it, right? And so, anyway, that's like as realistic of a prediction I have. I mean, more practically, I think Bitcoin is the best way to resolve of this debt situation. I think Bitcoin's far more American than the US dollar. I was born and raised on freedom, liberty, democracy, immigration, the American dream. None of that, I think, is realized in the dollar and in society today. And so I hope Bitcoin becomes part of America's story, which then I think will ripple through the rest of the world. Funny enough, you know, coming to El Salvador and what happened here, it looks like it's in the reverse, which, you know, in hindsight makes sense, but I'm not sure. And I'm not even sure if I answered your question, but
yeah,
I don't know, man.
It's hard to know. Yeah, I know. I'm not expecting some, you know, prediction that I'm going to pull up in the year 2040.
Totally.
And, you know, see if it was right or wrong.
Well, the problem, or like the really scary thing about the question is, logically, I have an answer for you. Yeah. But unfortunately, there's like a lot of violence and self-interested malice probably that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. The fear, or the reason that people are uncomfortable making predictions, is because they can't imagine the U.S. sacrificing this hegemony and this overall position within the world that they have had for the last, whatever, 170 to 100 years. And so that's what's scary about it, is oftentimes these things result in world wars. Mm. And what terrifies me is that's not the craziest idea anymore.
Oh, no.
And so that's what is fearful for me. I do think that there's a way where we peacefully resolve of it all, and we have the digital version of gold, and we go back on this type of standard and restoring time and energy to the collective populace, and there'll be a middle class again. And then there's a version where, you know, the world goes out kicking and screaming from this chapter. And that's the scary part about that question is speculating
on that. It can really go in a lot of different directions. Right. I wouldn't be surprised if the USA and other legacy brand countries, you know, like the UK, Germany, France, maybe even Japan, I wouldn't be surprised if they sort of end up being laggards with this. So if you were to go back 5 years ago, I mean, would you have predicted that El Salvador would be the first country in the entire world to make Bitcoin legal tender?
No, dude. When I landed here, I wouldn't have predicted it. I got a DM from the government saying, we want to talk about Bitcoin, I wouldn't have predicted it. Yeah. No, of course not.
Yeah. What I see happening is other small forward-thinking countries, like I live in the UAE. Mm-hmm. I could very easily see within the next decade, countries like the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, maybe Kuwait, Oman, like these Gulf countries, maybe even Saudi Arabia, maybe some other smaller countries in Central and South America, perhaps some countries in Africa, I can see them being quicker to start adopting Bitcoin officially than the USA and China and Russia and, you know, these big countries where things just move slowly and where they have, you know, they've got all this military power and they're kind of stuck in their ways. A little bit, and they're not as willing to be. I think in El Salvador, it's a bit like, heck, like, why not? Like, why don't, you know, like, why don't we do this? Like, let's give this thing a try. And I think they're just being a smaller country, you know, 6 million people versus 350 million. You can just move things quicker. You can make things happen. Yeah, it's a risk in some ways, but the potential consequences are not as, you know, there's a lot more to gain. I think there's a lot more to gain for the U.S., than there is to lose. But I think in the sort of, for lack of a better term, in the sort of like boomer mentality, boomer fiat mentality, it's just hard for it to happen. Maybe it'll be more of a generational shift in some of these legacy countries.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. I think the one of the bigger problems, in my opinion, is the politics.
Yep.
So the idea that we have a central bank that's separate from the government is a fallacy, right? We live in this, you know, fiscal dominance where, you know, Janet Yellen in the U.S. Treasury is really the boss of Jerome Powell in the central bank. Jerome Powell's job is to create market dynamics that sustain Janet's ability to resource and fund whatever the Democratic Party wants to do. And it's the same for the Republican. To be clear, I'm not a politics guy. Mm-hmm. I'm public on record. I've never actually voted in my life. So that's how much of like one side or the other guy I am. I'm very much not super interested in politics. But the problem is giving people the truth at this point doesn't get you elected. That's the problem. What gets you elected is like, hey, I'm going to give you guys a bunch of free stuff. Of course, nothing's free, but it's very difficult I think, to envision. What we're seeing in Argentina is fascinating because there was enough civil unrest and they were far enough down this chapter where someone campaigned on, hey, I'm going to blow it all up and it's going to hurt really bad for a while, but then we're going to be better off.
Yeah.
And that guy got elected. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if I campaigned against Trump and Biden and said, hey guys, your gas prices are going to be screwed. I'm going to blow everything up. Banks are going to fail. The deposits you have in your savings account, that was never there. It's actually gone. But on the other side of it, after like another Great Depression, we're going to be the real America. Yes. I would never get elected.
No.
And so that, I think, is the real issue, is the conflation between politics and money. And unfortunately, just like how the political system is set up is you got to get elected. And you get elected by persisting the system that is. And like, what if I campaigned and said, you know, all of your retirement savings plans and your IRAs, like those are gone.
Yep.
So I think that's the problem. For El Salvador, I thought it was interesting. Like at the time, I had no idea that it all was going to happen how it did. But what I think is interesting is, you're right, is that they have the – so they went through a really devastating civil war, lost their own currency.
Mm-hmm.
So they're on the dollar. So they actually didn't have a currency that was you're able to print and debase time and energy from the populace.
Yep.
So for that reason, I find it fascinating. The next chapter of like, no way – it was a nation state adopting Bitcoin. The next is a nation state that has their own currency adopting Bitcoin.
Yes.
The nation state that prints their own currency to buy Bitcoin is going to be a huge deal. So for El Salvador, it was massive, but it makes a lot of sense to your point in hindsight, is that it is small, it has the most to gain. But you know, talking to the government and understanding their intent, it really was out of respect for the people, is like allowing them to persist and save and exchange time and energy on the market's terms. That was like the coolest part about it. But yeah, for those reasons, I think change in America is going to have to come through civil unrest like we saw in Argentina, unfortunately, which no one wants to live through. But I think we're already starting to see it. Like yes. Inflation is a known term. And I actually have a lot of hope. The fact that Trump is campaigning on Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's interesting. I saw that.
So I think that's – I actually – I'm really hopeful on that. Trump, I know to be just, don't know him actually, but through watching TV and stuff, I know him to be transactional.
Mm-hmm.
So not to say that I think Trump is a Bitcoiner and all in like someone like myself. But it is interesting that the people have garnered enough power through this distributed decentralized currency to impact an election.
Yes.
And that there's enough civil unrest where the people now, how many elections in a row have they been won or lost based on campaigns directly down to like a singular topic or topics that are driven by the voice of the people? So I do think we're getting to the point, even in America, where there's enough civil unrest where we could see something like, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump said, I'm going to buy Bitcoin for America as well, just to make those promises. And whether they're kept or not, I think that's directionally a good start. I don't know, man. This topic freaks me out a little bit. The World War stuff really terrifies me.
Yeah.
History would point us in that direction, but I'm really hopeful. The problem too is everyone that was in World War II is dead. Not because they died in the war, but it's so long ago.
It's a long time ago.
And so the problem when you have these turnings of cycles or these chapter fours or however people define and call them is that all the people that learn the hard lessons are gone, right? That's how generational wealth gets ruined, is the great-grandson that inherited the company that's worth $10 billion doesn't have the knowledge and the pain and the grit and the sacrifice that the great-grandfather does,
yes,
right? And they blow it. And so that's my fear, is hopefully we've been good enough at, you know, history and information transformation so that we have learned and don't, because it's crazy to me when a president will send people to war as if that's something that you can casually do. So I don't know. It's a freaky topic. I just try and have optimism and hope and Bitcoin. Thank whoever you believe in for Bitcoin.
No doubt, man. What's your plans for the future of Strike?
We
barely even talked about that, crazily enough.
Well, honestly, sometimes when I do my business and Bitcoin and my business or my story, I feel too salesman-y. So I actually kind of appreciate that. Strike, I mean, goal is to deliver better money to everyone in the world through Bitcoin. So we strive to be the best Bitcoin company in the world. We're distinctly different because we don't focus on any of the other cryptos. We just try and be better at just Bitcoin than everyone else. And so the goal is to continue to do that.
When does it come into the UK?
We listen to customers. It comes to the UK at the end of June.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
The vision is that I don't believe in any of the other cryptos under this notion that I don't think they're any good at, you know, storing and saving and exchanging time and energy.
Yes.
All right. I think whether it's smart contracts, this or that, and to me, those are far less interesting. And I think that the, one of the reasons I founded Strike is I think there needs to be a company, and hopefully many, that are solely focused on financial services for the future of money.
Yes.
And so, yeah, we're really driven by listening to our customers. I think that's the healthiest relationship a business can have is, hey, we believe this is the future of money. So do you guys. And, you know, how can I help you store, save, exchange your time and energy? And so that's why we've been able to do what we've been able to do. And so that's what we'll continue to do, I guess, from the highest level.
I love it. Jack, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for the gift of your time and your knowledge. I do a lot of podcasts, and this has been one where, like, I've really felt like I'm learning certain things on a topic that I feel like I already know quite a lot about. So thank you for that. And I hope it has been of massive value to everybody listening. Last thing, where can people find and follow you online?
Jack Mallard is my real name, which in Bitcoin, sometimes you're like, Satoshi Nakamoto, what's his real name? So Jack Mallard is my real name. You guys can find me. That's my handle everywhere. And you're a gem, brother. You really are. So thanks for what you do. And I appreciate you having me. I
appreciate it, man. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.